History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 29, Resurrection Men. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about resurrection men and the business of cadavers in early and Victorian Boston, including a secret club of Harvard medical students that allegedly included one of our founding fathers. But before we talk corpses, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Last week, we felt the need to apologize because our historical anniversaries were so skewed toward the Revolutionary period. This week, they're dominated by the Civil War era, starting with Monday. Monday is May 22nd, and on May 22nd, 1856, Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner was attacked on the floor of the United States Senate. I know our current president believes...
No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly.
But Sumner was beaten nearly to death with a cane by a U.S. congressman. I think that counts as being treated worse or more unfairly. 3 days before, Sumner had delivered a speech that ended, "Above all towers the majestic form of Washington once more, as on the bloody field, bidding them to remember those rights of human nature for which the War of Independence was waged. Such a cause, thus sustained, is invincible. Let the voters everywhere, while rejoicing in their own rights, help to guard the equal rights of distant fellow citizens, that the shrines of popular institutions, now desecrated, may be sanctified anew, that the ballot box, now plundered, may be restored, and that the cry, 'I am an American citizen,' may not be sent forth in vain against outrage of every kind." The address was called "The Crime Against Kansas," condemning the spread of slavery and reportedly slandering South Carolina and its senator, Andrew Butler. Congressman Preston Brooks, a fellow South Carolinian and cousin to Butler, was enraged. He considered challenging Sumner to a duel, but decided that would grant Sumner too much honor. Instead, Brooks chose to beat Sumner as he might beat his wife or a dog. On May 22nd, Brooks confronted Sumner in the Senate chamber. "Mr. Sumner, I have read your speech twice over carefully. It is a libel on South Carolina and Mr. Butler, who is a relative of mine." As Sumner began to stand up, Brooks smashed him in the head with a wooden cane with a gold head. Sumner was knocked down and trapped under the heavy desk, which was bolted to the floor. But Brooks continued to strike Sumner until Sumner ripped the desk from the floor. By this time, Sumner was blinded by his own blood, and he staggered up the aisle and collapsed, lapsing into unconsciousness. Brooks continued to beat the motionless Sumner until his cane broke. Other senators attempted to help Sumner, but were blocked by a second South Carolina congressman brandishing a pistol and shouting, "Let them be." Senator Sumner took 3 years to recover fully from the attack, returning to the Senate in 1859. While his fellow anti-slavery Republicans urged a more moderate approach, he became a leader of the radical Republicans, saying, "When crime and criminals are thrust before us, they are to be met by all the energies that God has given us by argument, scorn, sarcasm, and denunciation." His first address on the Senate floor after returning was a merciless attack on slavery and slaveholders. "Say, sir, in your madness, that you own the sun, the stars, the moon, but do not say that you own a man, endowed with a soul that shall live immortal, when sun and moon and stars have passed away."
On May 23, 1900, William H. Kearny became the first African American to be awarded a Medal of Honor, the U.S. military's highest award for valor. He had waited almost 37 years. William Harvey Kearny was born into slavery in Virginia and eventually escaped to freedom in Massachusetts with the help of the Underground Railroad. William was a literate young man and felt a call to the ministry. But when the Civil War began, he believed he had a higher calling. "I could best serve my God serving my country and my oppressed brothers. The sequel, in short, I enlisted for the war." After Governor Andrew authorized the recruitment of African American soldiers in early 1863, Kearny joined the 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry Regiment and soon rose to the rank of sergeant. That summer, the unit participated in a series of battles and skirmishes in the South Carolina Sea Islands as part of the greater Union drive towards Charleston. Fort Wagner was a Confederate stronghold on Morris Island, protecting the southern approach to Charleston Harbor. The island was narrow, and the only way to attack the fort was along a strip of beach only 60 yards wide. Colonel Robert Gould Shaw volunteered the 54th to lead the charge. They stormed the guns of the fort and held the walls for a few hours before being driven back. Almost half of the 600-man regiment was killed, wounded, or captured. Kearny's not a named character in the 1989 film Glory about the 54th Massachusetts Volunteers, but his act of bravery is alluded to in the closing scene. As the regiment prepares to lead the assault on Fort Wagner, Colonel Shaw, played by Matthew Broderick, says,
"If this man should fall, who will lift the flag and carry on?
I will."
In reality, the color guard was killed in the assault. Seeing him fall, Sergeant Kearny took the unit's flag from his dying hands and carried it forward, leading the regiment to the walls of the fort. He found himself alone on the wall of the fort with enemy troops advancing toward him. He furled the flag and began withdrawing back toward Union lines. As he rose from a ditch to find a route across, he received his first wound, later writing, "The bullet I now carry in my body came whizzing like a mosquito and I was shot. Not being prostrated by the shot, I continued my course, yet had not gone far before I was struck by a second shot." As he came within view of friendly forces from New York, he was hit by a third bullet, but would not take the New Yorkers' offer to carry the colors for him, refusing to turn them over to anyone other than a member of the 54th Volunteers. As he was helped back toward his unit, a fourth bullet grazed his head. Finally, he was able to hand over the colors of the 54th to his comrades, saying, "Boys, the old flag never touched the ground." Sergeant Kearny was given an honorable discharge, and he returned home to New Bedford. He worked maintaining the city's streetlights, and later as a mail carrier. He married and had a daughter. When the country was finally willing to acknowledge the service and heroism of its African-American soldiers, his Medal of Honor citation would read, "When the color sergeant was shot down, this soldier grasped the flag, led the way to the parapet, and planted the colors thereon. When the troops fell back, he brought off the flag under a fierce fire in which he was severely wounded."
Wednesday is May 24th. As you might remember from our Black History Month series, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 became a flashpoint in Massachusetts. With officials and citizens of free states unwillingly enlisted into the services of the slaveholding South, Boston abolitionists vowed to resist slave power. An abolitionist mob rescued the first man to be arrested in Boston under the act, delivering him to the Underground Railroad and eventually freedom in Canada. A few weeks later, an attempt to free the second accused fugitive failed, and he was returned to slavery. On May 24, 1854, Anthony Burns became the third accused fugitive to be arrested in Boston. Before he was returned to Virginia, black and white abolitionists would make a desperate, bloody attempt to save him. They stormed the federal courthouse in Boston. Shots were fired, and a guard was stabbed to death in the fray. The rescue was unsuccessful, and Burns was sent back to bondage in Virginia before Boston's 12th Baptist Church was eventually able to buy his freedom.
Fort Warren, May 25th, 1865. I rose early, saw Boston in the distance. Fort Warren just ahead. We took our last breakfast with Captain Fraley. He informed us that General Dix was at the fort and would come aboard to receive us at 10. The gunners got ready to fire a salute in the general's honor. 10 came. General Dix sent two officers, Colonel McMahon of his staff to represent him, and Lieutenant Ray, adjutant of the post. I expected we would go to General Dix, but was disappointed. Lieutenant Woodman of the fort met us at the landing. To him I was turned over. Lieutenant Woodman brought me immediately inside the fort. After going through the sally port and descending some steps, he stopped at the first room to the left, saying, "This is your room," or "These are your quarters," I forget which. I asked if I could not see General Dix. I wished very much to see him about sending word home about my diet and conditions of prison life. He said no, and left. I surveyed the room. A coal fire was burning. A table and chair were in the center. A narrow, iron, bunk-like bedstead with mattress and covering was in a corner. The floor was stone, large square blocks. The door was locked. For the first time in my life, I had the full realization of being a prisoner. I was alone. These were the words Confederate Vice President Alexander Stevens recorded in his diary upon being imprisoned on George's Island in Boston Harbor. Stevens had been a longtime congressman from Georgia and was a reluctant traitor. Although he was a devoted slaver and white supremacist, he voted against secession in 1861, favoring compromise with the northern states. Because he was seen as a principled man, he was elected vice president of the Confederacy. After his capture at the tail end of the Civil War, he would be imprisoned in Boston Harbor for about 6 months. His cell, the first room to the left, can be visited with a short ferry ride from downtown Boston.
Friday is May 26th. On May 26th, 1774, Thomas Gage, the new royal governor of Massachusetts, addressed the provincial assembly. His Majesty, having been pleased to appoint me governor and captain general of his province of the Massachusetts Bay, and my commissions having been read and published, I have met you for the election of counselors for the ensuing year, on which business you have been convened agreeable to your charter, and as that work is finished, you will proceed as you shall judge fit to the consideration of such other matters as may properly come before you, and that you judge ought to be entered upon, assured that I shall with pleasure concur with you to the utmost of my power in all matters that tend to the welfare and prosperity of the province. I make mention of the first of next month because I have the king's particular commands for holding the general court at Salem from that day until his majesty shall have signified his royal will and pleasure for holding it again at Boston. This was probably the first the legislators had heard that the body was going to move to Salem, like it or not. This move was meant to help the governor maintain control over the legislature, and the arrangement lasted until the Massachusetts Government Act dissolved the legislature that fall. From that moment on, the crown lost control of the colony, as the Massachusetts Provincial Congress was formed as a revolutionary shadow government, preparing the people for the war that would follow.
Last week, we mentioned the 1775 British raid on Grape Island, near Weymouth, where they tried to seize hay and livestock. The raid put the Patriot camps at Roxbury and Cambridge on high alert. On May 27, 1775, a party of about 200 or 300 men from the Cambridge camp was deployed to Noddle's Island and Hog Island to gather any livestock or useful supplies that could be put to use by the enemy. At about 11 in the morning, the party waded across Belle Isle Creek to Hog Island, now East Boston. 20 to 30 men continued on, wading across the shallows to Noddle's Island, while the rest of the party began gathering sheep and cattle on Hog Island. The group on Noddle's Island found 4 horses, 3 cows, and began burning hay. Unfortunately, they didn't know that about 40 Royal Marines had been stationed on the island for moments just like this. They began to fire on the Patriots, and the firing attracted the attention of a British schooner and a sloop, which soon added their fire to cover the approach of a larger party of Marines and whaleboats. The small Patriot party retreated to a ditch, where they ambushed the approaching Marines, killing and wounding several. In the meantime, schooner HMS Diana was ordered to cut off the Patriot retreat, sailing as close to the mainland behind Noddle's Island as she could. As the Marines landed on Noddle's Island, the Americans retreated again to the mainland. As the tide turned and the Diana found itself under heavy fire from the American guns, she was ordered to retreat, but ran aground in the creek. General Israel Putnam approached the ship and offered to accept their surrender. They refused, exchanging heavy fire with the Americans until about 11 p.m. At daybreak the following morning, the Americans piled hay around the Diana and set her on fire. She soon exploded, and both sides withdrew. The Americans lost 1 man killed and 4 wounded. Accounts of British casualties vary, but they seem to have been higher. The Americans carried the day, though the series of Harbor Island's battles would continue throughout that summer.
Finally, Sunday is May 28th. On May 28th, 1679, Massachusetts made it illegal to sell strong drink to the militia during training. Whereas there is an abusive and evil practice taken up in several places of this colony upon training days and other public conventions of people upon civil occasions, diverse persons taking liberty to bring into the field and other places near such concourse of people, considerable quantities of wine, strong liquors, cider, and other inebriating drinks, having no license to do so, whereby many people, both English and Indians, that come to such meetings, as well as soldiers, commit many disorders of drunkenness, fighting, neglect of duty, and for prevention whereof, it is ordered by this court and the authority thereof, that henceforth no person whatsoever shall presume to bring into the field and sell by retail upon such occasions any wine, strong liquor, cider, or any other inebriating drinks, excepting beer of a penny a quart, unless he or they so doing have license from the hands of two magistrates or the chief military officer or officers in the field, upon penalty of forfeiting all such strong drink, and paying a fine of £5 one half to the informer, and the other half to the county treasury.
And now for our main topic, we're going to explore the resurrection industry in early Boston. In the late 18th century, modern surgery began to take shape, and medicine in general started to become influenced by science as we know it today. Boston has been a hub for both academia and medical advancement, and our city's contributions to the medical field include the first use of ether and the development of X-ray technology, among many, many others. One of the things, perhaps the primary thing, that enabled leaps and bounds in the 18th and 19th centuries was firsthand knowledge of the workings of the human body through the dissection of cadavers. We advanced from beliefs in the balancing of the four humors to an understanding of the body's organs and systems. However, the study of cadavers was decidedly not embraced by the public. In fact, it was illegal in many parts of the world. Massachusetts took a surprisingly more liberal approach. By 1647, the courts were allowing one dissection every 4 years. Puritan beliefs justified the act, reasoning that fates were predetermined and the destruction of the body was the punishment for a sinful life, and merely preparation for eternal hellfire.
Once every 4 years was not enough, and a black market was born. The state legislature, in an effort to reduce both dueling and grave robbing, passed legislation in 1784 that allowed the bodies of those killed in duels and those executed for killing another in a duel to be given to medical colleges. And still, demand far surpassed supply. In a letter that appeared in his autobiography in 1860, John Collins Warren describes a night in 1796. Having understood that a man without relations was to be buried in the North Burying Ground, I formed a party, of which Dr. William Ingalls was one. He was a physician of Boston at that time. We reached the spot at 10 o'clock at night. The night was rather light. We soon found the grave, but after proceeding a while, were led to suspect a mistake, and went to another place. Here we found ourselves wrong, and returned to the first, and having set watches, we proceeded rapidly, uncovering the coffin by breaking it open. We took out the body of a stout young man, put it in a bag, and carried it to the burying ground wall. As we were going to lift it over and put it in the chaise, we saw a man walking along the edge of the wall outside, smoking. A part of us disappeared. One of the company met him, stopped him from coming on, and entered into conversation with him. This individual of our party affected to be intoxicated, while he contrived to get into a quarrel with the stranger. After he had succeeded in doing this, another of the party, approaching, pretended to side with the stranger and ordered the other to go about his business. Taking the stranger by the arm, he led him off in a different direction to some distance, then left him and returned to the burying ground. The body was then quickly taken up and packed in the chaise between two of the parties, who drove off to Cambridge with their booty. Two of us stayed to fill the grave, but my companion, being alarmed, soon left the burying ground. And I, knowing the importance of covering up the grave and effacing the vestiges of our labor, remained, with no very agreeable sensations, to finish the work. However, I got off without further interruption, drove, with the tools, to Cambridge, and arrived there just before daylight. When my father, Dr. Warren, founder of Harvard Medical School, came up in the morning to lecture and found that I had been engaged in this scrape, he was very much alarmed, but when the body was uncovered and he saw what a fine, healthy subject it was, he seemed to be as much pleased as I ever saw him. The body lasted the entire anatomy course through.
The elder John Warren, who would go on to found Massachusetts General Hospital, founded Harvard Medical College 14 years earlier, in 1782. However, medical instruction had already been a prominent piece of the college's offerings. Both John and his brother, physician and patriot leader Dr. Joseph Warren, studied medicine at Harvard. When founding the college, John insisted that the school provide a medical library, a dissection theater, and required students to demonstrate a thorough knowledge of human anatomy through cadavers. By this time, students were permitted to dissect the bodies of executed criminals, but this supply line was inconsistent and left learning up to chance. The issue of supply and demand opened up opportunities for those willing to roll up their sleeves. Students at colleges around the country began to hire the services of so-called resurrection men to supply fresh cadavers. These men could have been employees of the schools, as was Ephraim Littlefield, who we discussed in connection to the Parkman murder in episode 24, enterprising criminals, or simply those like Paul Revere's son who were willing to do a favor for their friends. Grave robbing was a relatively easy way to make a buck, as there wasn't much risk in the early days of resurrecting. Grave robbing didn't become a felony in Massachusetts until 1815, when the legislature passed a bill called An Act to Protect the Sepulchres of the Dead. These men were more likely to face a beating from mourning relatives than legal repercussions. In the 18th and 19th centuries, there were about 24 resurrection riots in American cities in response to the procurement and treatment of cadavers. In addition to the grave robbers, professors, doctors, and medical students faced violent mobs. We didn't find accounts of any notable resurrection riots in Boston, but we'd welcome any listener insight on the topic. So how does one avoid a riot? By only digging up the poor, or those without relatives in town. We had a hard time pinning down a price for cadavers and inflation rates, but suffice it to say that one or two a year could keep you in comfort. Given the lack of any real consequences, the extreme cost, and the adventurous nature of stealing corpses, it isn't surprising that at Harvard, some students took up the task themselves. The Spunkers Club, or the Anatomical Club, founded around 1770, was not an official university club, as the main activity of the club was grave robbing corpses of recently deceased Bostonians. Notable members included Dr. John Collins Warren, whose tale we just heard, Samuel Adams Jr., son of the patriot rabble-rouser, and William Eustace, future governor of Massachusetts. The Spunkers took their work very seriously. In a 1775 letter, John Warren praises the club and criticizes the sloppiness of a robbery where the grave was left open. It was done with so little decency and caution, it need scarcely be said that it could not have been the work of any of our friends of the Spunkers. Where the necessities of society are in conflict with the law and with public opinion, the crime consists not in the deed, but in permitting its discovery.
Related to the necessities of society, Massachusetts passed the Anatomy Act in 1831 that allowed the state's medical schools to take possession of the unclaimed bodies that belonged to the poor, insane, and those who died in prison. So, what brought about the end of the resurrection era? That's a great question, and one that there doesn't seem to be much written on. One must discern that legislation changed, legitimate sources of cadavers opened up, and perhaps ethics evolved as well. We did find mention of an interesting case in Boston in 1974. Four doctors at Boston City Hospital, now Boston Medical Center, who began a study on how pregnant women metabolize common antibiotics, were charged under the Commonwealth's 1815 grave robbing statute. Violation of sepulture. Whoever, not being lawfully authorized by the proper authorities, willfully digs up, disinters, removes, or conveys away a human body or the remains thereof, shall be punished by imprisonment in the state prison for no more than 3 years, or in jail for not more than 2.5 years, or by a fine of not more than $2,000. Massachusetts Grave Robbing Statute. The doctors had permission from the mothers to conduct the study, but not explicit permission to conduct post-mortem autopsies on the fetuses. The doctors were indicted before the charges were dropped. It's worth noting that they in no way violated standard hospital research procedures that were common at the time. The medical research community was shaken by this case and the growing power of the anti-abortion lobby and the emerging notion that life could begin before birth. As a modern-day reminder of our medical research past, evidence of the medical college's dissections and experiments were uncovered in 1999 with the renovation of Holden Chapel, the third oldest building on the Harvard campus. Built in 1744, Holden Chapel was home to Harvard Medical School's medical laboratory from 1782 to about 1850. During the renovation, a construction worker operating a bulldozer in the chapel's basement discovered human remains and various lab waste when his machine broke through a wall into an old well. Archaeologists uncovered various laboratory and domestic trash, such as glass test tubes, graduated cylinders, flasks, specimen jars, chamber pot fragments, and leather shoes. According to a forensic analysis, the bones are from body parts from at least 11 people, males and females, adults and children. The bones had cut marks consistent with dissection techniques and vertebrae mounted in anatomical order. This was an incredibly important discovery that helped document a significant time in the university's history.
If you'd like to learn more about Resurrection Men in Boston, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/030. We'll have a link to a National Geographic article on how cadavers are procured today, which, fair warning, does contain some graphic images. We'll have a History Channel article with additional details on the Spunkers, a photo of Holden Chapel, a brief history of American anatomy riots from the National Museum of Civil War Medicine, and an article on cemetery guns and grave torpedoes used to protect graves from would-be robbers. We'll have links to Colonial Comics Volume 2, A History of New England in Graphic Novel Format, which has a chapter on the Spunkers, and to the 2003 book Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, as well as an episode of the Stuff You Should Know podcast about the Golden Age of Grave Robbing. We got a nice comment this week from a teacher who goes by TimGDB on Twitter. He was reacting to our episode on Wonder Woman and said, "Great episode. Do you have a link to the letter to the Maine natives you talked about? I'd love to use it in class." Thanks for the kind words, Tim. You can always find links to the sources for our historical anniversaries in the episode's show notes. We've stopped mentioning that after every single anniversary because it seemed pretty repetitive. But we do try to post an original source, a picture, an article, or something for each historical anniversary. This week, you can find all those at hubhistory.com/030.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, we'd love it if you could write us a brief review. It is the best way to help others find the show.
That's all for now. As we head into Memorial Day weekend, next week's show is a little bit up in the air. We'll either be back next week with a short episode, or we'll talk to you the following week.